Sunday Papers on Off the Ball.
Yeah, good afternoon, and you're very welcome to Sunday's Off the Ball. Neil Tracy here with you until 7 o'clock this evening. It's a packed day. We have two live Premier League commentaries to bring you. First up at the John Smith Stadium at 2 o'clock, Manchester United will be looking to keep their slim hopes of a Champions League finish alive. They're away to Huddersfield. Commentary from Stephen Doyle and Brian Kerr at the John Smith Stadium. And after that, at 4:30, Arsenal host a Brighton side who may have been celebrating last night after Cardiff's relegation was confirmed. Aidan O'Hara and Sarah O'Connor are joining me for the Sunday paper review. But first, though, we have to start with the sad news emerging this morning that Eugene McGee, the legendary Gaelic football manager and manager of the Offaly side who defeated Kerry and ended the famous five in a row hopes in 1982, died last night. Eugene fell ill suddenly at a family event. He was best known for that great Offaly All-Ireland win in 1982, as well as managing UCD to All-Ireland club titles, managing Cavan as well, and as well as that was an Irish manager in the international rules. Joining me on the line first to discuss all that is Mick Foley of the Sunday Times. Mick, who would have written the great book Kings of September about Offaly's win against Kerry in 1982. Mick, good afternoon.
Hi Neil, how are you?
Not too bad, Mick. I don't know where you were when you heard the news this morning. You would have known Eugene quite well, I imagine, through not just through your book Kings of September, but you also would have worked with him for a time. I would have imagined he was a columnist with you at the Sunday Tribune around the same time. Would I be right?
Well, he was a little bit before my time, but I would have known Eugene, I suppose, God, 20 years, you know, between press boxes and different things like that, and obviously then, as you say, through the book. So it's a terrible shock, really. I mean, he was such an extraordinary guy in so many different ways. Like, I mean, you mentioned his football side of things. He was also a journalist for a long years as well, as a college, with the Tribune, with the Independent, managing editor of the Longford Leader. I mean, his influence spanned, obviously, the GA, but far beyond that as well. And he's just a terrible loss. And just, you know, just when I have the chance just to pass on my condolences to everybody in Offaly and in Longford and he and everybody around Walsh, that, you know, it's a very sad day.
What would have inspired you to write about that Offaly 82 success and would have drawn you to someone like Eugene McGee?
Well, I think that's look. He's central to that. He's central to that story. When you think that when he took over Offaly back in the mid-70s, around 1976, it was only 4 years since they'd won their last All Ireland, but they had gone to such a low ebb that they needed something radically different. And in McGee, I mean, his background, even his family background, would have said that this guy thought in a totally different way. He was a radical in thought and deed, actually. Like his brother. He would have had a brother, Father Phil McGee, who would have been a very strong influence in for back in the 60s, would have brought in a manager from Cavan who would have guided long over a very successful period of time in the late 60s. And Eugene would have been hugely influenced by him. He's even with UCD, tremendous mind for the game and how it could be played and how to train and how it could be played in a different way. I mean, he wasn't a great footballer himself, terrific and a terrific way to the game. I was thinking, just when I was thinking about him this morning, I remember him telling me, like, his very first training session with Offaly, a bag of footballs down, and as I say, this is only a few years after they had won an All-Ireland. He took a bag of footballs down out onto the training field. He was wearing his old blue UCD top and all these guys were there going, who is this person? He threw all the footballs out and he said, right, all of you 20 yards out from the goal, all over the bar. And the idea was to say, you've done this and you've done that, but we're going to basics. I don't care who you are. I don't care what you've won. You have to prove yourself all over again now. And that was his... He was just such a straight talker, a straight thinker. He didn't suffer fools gladly. And Offaly needed that kind of clarity of thought. And, I mean, you know, you go forward and you look at what he did with that Offaly team. I mean, the stuff he did was revolutionary, even if you think about it in modern terms. Like, I mean, McGee, 1 year he went over to watch Arsenal train. He brought Richie Connor with him, and they went over and watched Arsenal. This would have been in the era of Brady, Stapleton, Dave O'Leary, just to watch them train and see what they could learn. He brought a video camera to matches back in the late 70s, try and record the matches and have one right or wrong. Now, the video camera mightn't have worked every time, but that's the way he was thinking. Diet-wise, you know, McGee, like, they might have got a fine feed at training. Now it was a slab of milk, and sometimes the training was so hard they couldn't even keep the milk down. So he was setting, was thinking a different way. He was setting new standards for these guys. Now, he was lucky in one sense, I suppose, that he was coming into an Offaly team that had a lot of very, very good young players, and the likes of Connor as well, to help him along to bring those ideas to reality. But like even something like you know, team analysis, right, and analysing the opposition for that Offaly team back in the late '70s, early '80s, he would have given every starting player a little before they went, maybe the week before, detailing three key points about their opponents. So they would have gone out with a good knowledge, and like this is totally beyond the beyond for that era. But if you think about it in modern terms, it's absolutely kind of, you
it's
know,
basic.
He was a long, long
it's
way
basic
ahead of
these days. It's, you know, it's the basic level of analysis we see these days, but it was so revolutionary at the time. Before we go, Mick, as well, I just want to ask you as well, like, you mentioned how revolutionary and how much of a football pioneer he was back in the 70s and 80s, but in modern times as well, he would have been a large part in the way the game is now formed, being part of the Football Review Committee and, you know, overseeing, we'll say, things like the introduction of the black card, which, while some people might say isn't really working, at the very least, he was involved trying to actually make Gaelic football a better sport.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he was involved with committees for years, but the two that stand out to me was the Football Development Committee back in 1999, which would have come up with the idea back then of a three-tier football championship. And there would have been limitations on who could play in the Sam Maguire Cup, and so on and so forth. And it was extremely controversial at the time, but this was the way McGee was thinking even then, that you know, there was something in with structure and it needed change, and you move forward to 2013 and the black card, and I can remember that Congress, and I remember when the black card was passed through, he was actually very emotional. It really meant a huge amount to get that through. Now you can say, as you say, you can argue it up and down, but here was that he was forever thinking forward. It was all forward looking. I mean, you know, when you think of it, like, he was born and raised in a small place in North Longford, but he was conditioned to think bigger than was it right in front of him. Mm-hmm. Or trying to imagine the future for whatever team or whatever situation he was involved in, and, you know, I mean, he'd be really, really missed.
Okay, Mick, the line on the phone there isn't great, so we might just leave it there, but thanks for taking the time this afternoon to take a call with us.
No problem.
Okay, that was Mick Foley there talking about the sad loss this morning, the sudden death of Eugene McGee, former UCD Offaly Cavan and Irish International Rules Manager. It is time now to go into the Sunday pay-per-view. I'm joined this afternoon by Aidan O'Hara, Deputy Head of Sport with the Independent News and Media Group and football columnist as well, and also Sarah O'Connor, Head of Sports Marketing and Sponsorship with Wilson Hartnell. Before I get in and look at the back pages, Aidan, speaking to you earlier on, Eugene as well, as someone you would have kind of crossed paths with.
Yeah,
would have
crossed
paths with. Would have been a football columnist in the Irish
Football
Independent.
Columnist in the Independent, yeah. As Mick said, like, I mean, you'd never be stuck for a headline, you know, reading his pieces. He was to the point in what he was trying to get across. And I guess, again, as Mick said, like, that would be what made him such a good manager, where messages are simple. If you want to get the best out of players, simple messages and go from there. But yeah, like, and he was always, as well, you might read the piece yourself and, you know, being from a bit of a younger generation, you might read it and you think, you know, it might be a bit old-fashioned or something like that. That might be the thought across your mind. And then you realise down on Monday morning, everyone's talking about what he's written, and you're going to the match the following week and people are on the train or on the bus, and then you kind of, you know, get yourself back in your box. So, like, he was forthright, he was to the point, but he always had an opinion, and never afraid to express that opinion, and he'd be a sad loss now.
Yeah, Sarah, would you have met him down the years?
No, I never had the privilege, but just, you know, hearing, you know, Mick speak about all that he achieved and gave back, I think, probably as well, to Gaelic Games, both kind of locally and then obviously nationally as well. I think those are exactly kind of the type of people that we need in sport, you know, that, you know, not only kind of obviously played at some level, went back to kind of manage, and then, you know, cared enough about the game to give us time to look at rules committees and everything, all with a view to kind of trying to make the sport better. And then obviously doing a very good job, according to Aidan, too, about reading on it. I mean, I would have enjoyed his articles, but I thought that was a good point by yours of never struggled for a headline from what he was saying.
No, you didn't. No, that was obviously, like, it's sort of one of those agenda setting kind of columnists that, you know, I know if you're doing paper reviews and stuff, and there's certain people who people might not necessarily agree with, or they might not necessarily like, or they think they might not like them, but they always read them.
They've
always, certainly on the Independence GA coverage on a Monday, all the way through the summer, all the way through the year, in fact, you know, for, I'm not sure, it felt like he wrote every week, I'm pretty sure he did. But, you know, to be having those sort of agenda setting things 40, 45 weeks of the year, it's not an easy thing to do, and when you speak to some people who would have worked with him, he's obviously a very skilled journalist, report very skilled in that regard. People would know him obviously as Offaly manager, but he seemed to have, just from speaking to people, like a hell of a lot more about him, and really, really genuine and really nice man.
Mm-hmm. We'll hopefully hear from a few more people later on in the show about you, Jimmy Gee, but we will get into the Sunday papers now, just to fly through the headlines very quickly. First of all, on the front page of the Sunday Times, there is another story on the FAI from Mark Tighe and Paul Rowan. FAI chief, €60,000 to his ex was agent fee. So that is the front page of the Sunday Times. The finance director of the Football Association of Ireland in 2014 was told that a €60,000 payment to a woman who was dating John Delaney at the time was an agent's fee relating to a friendly match between Ireland and England. Tony Dignam, who was the finance director from 2011 to 2014, is now one of two candidates vying to fill the vacant position of honorary secretary of the FAI board. He said he wanted to bring accountability and transparency to the association and was happy to answer questions about his time as an executive. On the back page of the Sunday Times this morning, they lead with a picture of Virgil van Dijk and his Liverpool teammates celebrating yesterday's van Dijk's goal in yesterday's 3-2 win against Newcastle at St James's Park. Fighting to the last, Salah injury blow mars Liverpool's last gasp 3-2 win at Newcastle. And also on the back page of the Sunday Times, they also have another story in the FAI about FIFA want answers from the FAI on Delaney. The crisis at FAI is facing a further investigation into its affairs, this time by the world governing body FIFA. So another FAI story we are going to be hearing a lot more of over the coming weeks and months to come. On the back page of the Sunday Independent, they also go with Liverpool's win yesterday, which keeps the title race alive going into the final weekend next week. Keeping the dream alive as Divock Origi celebrates his winning goal in the last 10 minutes of yesterday's game at St James's Park. On the back page of the Irish Mail on Sunday, over to you. Origi winner sends amazing title race down to the final week. Now Liverpool looks to look to ex-boss Rodgers to do them a favour against City. And also a line from Sean O'Brien at the bottom of that as well. I'd have stayed for quarter of the cash. This is Sean O'Brien. He's been speaking to all the Sunday writers this week about the Champions Cup final next week and his move to London Irish next year. It's something I think we will be talking about in the next half an hour or so. Sean O'Brien claims he would have stayed at Leinster for 25% of the money offered by London Irish, and admits there were aspects of his departure from his home province which he wouldn't be overly happy with. On the back page of the Sunday Mirror, again it's Liverpool. Awesome, Origi nicks late winner for Liverpool, but star Salah is carried off. That's after Liverpool's 3-2 win against Newcastle yesterday. The Daily Star as well, knockout, sub Origi rescues Klopp's title dream. Blow, fears for Mo after sickening KO clash. Mo Salah was stretchered off yesterday after a nasty collision with Newcastle goalkeeper Martin Dubravka. Jurgen Klopp did say though that he was sitting up and seemed well after the game, but you would assume he would be an enormous doubt for the Champions League semi-final second leg against Barcelona midweek. Reds on verge of glory, Klopp top again, but Mo KO blow to Barca hopes. That's Virgil van Dijk and Andy Robertson celebrating van Dijk's goal yesterday. Back page of the Sun, awesome is another headline getting a run again. Divock keeps title bid alive, but Mo's crocked. Newcastle 2, Liverpool 3. Divock Origi dominating the back pages. And also then on the Observer, if I can find the sports section there. Scroll through it. Stanway to Heaven is what they lead with Man City winning the Women's FA Cup final yesterday. Megan Campbell, the Republic of Ireland international, part of that Man City squad. City clinched domestic cup double to dash debutants' dream of Wembley upset. Now, guys, where do you want to start with this afternoon?
We were looking at the GAA following on from Eugene, and there's a few pieces in the across the papers with the championship starting with a bit of a whimper, really. Just a couple of games today. It explodes a bit into life next week, and it's kind of...
Mayo fans will tell you it is not starting with a whimper.
Well, yes.
Well, whatever Mayo fans are actually left in Ireland.
As a dub, I'm very wary of answering anything about Mayo fans. It's sort of reflected in some of the coverage, and that there's a couple of good player interviews. There's one series you spotted in Sean Moran in the Sunday Independent.
Crowe. Yeah, good insights from Lee Keegan as well, and even on the whimper point, Aidan spotted an article, a piece in the Indo again from Colm O'Rourke, kind of just the contrast, whether there's some lessons kind of for GAA. He's obviously spent some time recently down in Melbourne, and I think was kind of struck by the kind of volume of sport that was going on in the city, but then also just the publicity around it. Mm. And he kind of, in one paragraph, seems to indicate that they make talking points out of everything in Australia, and then further down is talking about the championship kind of getting underway with a bit of a, I suppose on a whimper, but Aidan and I were just talking when we were looking through the papers, and that, you know, sometimes actually there's kind of a lot more there when you kind of scratch beneath the surface. And probably the example of the Sean Moran article is a good one.
The Sean Moran article, obviously Dublin hurler, but it's a long way down the piece, and obviously, I mean, it's not something that he wants to make a big deal of. But he speaks about his Christian beliefs, and you know, I guess marriage for some people doesn't mean a lot. To us, it means a lot. I was brought up in a religious home. For me, it was the right move, the time to marry Carla. Speaks about going to a Christian group of like-minded people. The values that my parents instilled in us, I like to be able to live by them. These kind of things that you don't necessarily expect. I think he's 26. You know, you don't necessarily expect, you know, he's going to be playing in Nolan Park next week. So these pieces are great to read, where you know a little bit more about the person that you're watching. So people, I think, supporters, media, that you become a bit more invested in someone like Sean Moran because you know a little bit more about him. Mm. And I think sometimes the nature of the, certainly in GAA over the last number of years, is that's someone like Mick, who we had on earlier on, like obviously on the GAA beat a long, long time, and like there was a time 15 years ago, even I was covering GAA then 15, 20 years ago, and I'd still have a load of phone numbers of players who you'd ring them on a Thursday and they'd talk to you or they wouldn't talk to you, but you would have no issue in ringing them. I think now that wouldn't be, you know, I don't know if they'd answer the phone at all, or, you know, it'd be some kind of, you know, a sponsorship launch or something like that, like the Lee Keegan one today is...
It's a lot more tricky now, I think, you know, even... Going back to kind of hearing a few of those kind of forward thinking bits that kind of Eugene McGee kind of brought in terms of the player analysis or video analysis that we kind of take for granted, and we all see that as like an advancement, but then there's absolutely no doubt in terms of the other bit that's probably come in is the camps have got a lot more closed from top to bottom, and I suppose
it's professional, not just kind of on the pitch but off the pitch as well, that, you know, you're probably a bit more closed off and I suppose wary that someone is looking for the line as opposed to finding out about
you. That's the thing, to be fair,
seeing who you are.
We've come in and, you know, the first thing we talk about is the Christian belief, which is about 800 words into the piece. It's a very good piece. But that's the kind of, that's the line you'll take away from it. Now, like, there's different ways of, you could put a headline on that, you know, the Dublin hurler, you know, Christian, all that sort of stuff, and really, really, you know, blow it up as a big piece that it's all about this, and it's not. It's just part of him, and it's very well reflected in the piece, you know, about his hurling, and then it goes into his personal life and all that kind of stuff. It's well balanced, and you can understand why people are wary of, people are terrified of headlines, you know, usually, because you can say something here live radio. I could say something here and not even realise that I've said it, and then somebody comes out and, you know, says, "What did
someone
you say
else that? Decides?" Someone that's else the hears most that. Important thing.
Yeah,
you said.
And that's you know, that's sometimes is the nature, which I think why people are, say, athletes and things that are often more comfortable these days on things like, say, Players Tribune or, you know, even on radio or whatever, where it's all out there. It's not necessarily edited, or in the case of the Players Tribune, it's semi-edited copy approval kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But sometimes it can be a bit PR-ish in that regard.
Yeah, it's a funny balance, though, I think, sometimes to your point, because I think sometimes when you know more about the person, you know, like it's a brave thing to open yourself up. And in some ways, the players, like, they do that on the pitch and they've no bother with it, no matter the size of the crowd. But, you know, in a one-on-one in an interview, it can suddenly become a bigger deal. But I think as a fan, in a way, you become a bit more sympathetic to the players when you know that little bit more about them, because you kind of, I suppose, can relate to the, maybe to the vulnerability or whatever. And even in that Sean Moran piece, you know, he's saying there he was a slow, late kind of developer and, you know, wouldn't have been rated like when he was playing under 14 or under 16, but's gone on to be like a heartbeat of the Coola team and now a key player in the Dublin setup as well. Do you know, so I think it kind of can. I think that's the beauty of sport as well. It's not just the games, but when you know a little bit more about the human story behind these things, it actually draws you in.
It's human nature as well that someone will get a bit guarded sometimes.
I've been
at matches and press launches and things like that where you might have 2-3 minutes before the interview where you might be chatting with someone just waiting to get set up. But as soon as you actually put the mic in your hand and put it in front of them, you know, you can almost see them just kind of closing off a bit, and it's totally understandable.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I would have done Vox Pops in college. You know, all that sort of, I wouldn't have done much radio, but I've done Vox Pops in college, and it's like a mute button holding the phone up to somebody, and just this kind of, they clam up, and understandably so, because, as I said, like, when you're speaking, you're not necessarily thinking as clearly as you would do, and you see things sometimes on radio. If you're doing, say, a radio interview and you hear the transcript, you read the transcript of it. When it's down in print, it looks an awful lot harsher at times in print, and it looks a lot more scathing than it might necessarily do when you hear it on radio. And I think that's why people are sometimes wary of getting, the media and all that sort of stuff, you know, everyone's against us and all that kind of stuff, and you know, that's used sometimes. I mean, that's very much used on both sides at this stage, where people know, you know, if they need to get a message across, you suddenly see, you know, a player who you wouldn't ordinarily expect to be interviewed in the paper is suddenly given an interview to, you know, to a prominent journalist, and then that's setting an agenda, you know, when you don't see a sponsor, you know it's you know it's a serious issue. But yeah, like, there's been several roles over the years, be it, you know, to get, you know, talking about a lenient referee or talking about fouling or talking about, you know, there's been a few famous ones over the years. But it's, interviews like this, like, this isn't, I think Dermot refers to interviewing on a Friday afternoon in between work or a work break or something like that.
Yeah, on a Friday afternoon, Which is also interesting because Paul Flynn and Lee Keegan are both in the papers, one kind of indicating about move towards semi-professionalism and then the other one kind of saying, like, why wouldn't you want to play in Croke Park? We got really well looked after, which, it's interesting.
Keegan's very quite strong on just saying that, like, no one's forcing you to do this. Like, you do it for the love of, you know, the love of the game.
And Keegan is across a few of the papers?
He's across a few of the papers, He's in the Sunday
Times,
Sunday,
I think.
Time.
He's in the Daily Mail or the Sunday
World
Mail.
As well.
Sunday, yeah, Sunday World.
He's strong as he always is. Again, one of these fellas who
comparing Mayo to Tiger Woods.
Yeah, the Tiger Woods thing, the killer instinct, and that's what I admire about him, and things like that. That's, again, somebody who is a very interesting. He's an extremely interesting character, very prominent player.
Yeah.
A bit like, you know, say Philly McMahon or these guys. The guys who are not afraid, seem to be not afraid to speak their minds and stand by the points that they make, and they're happy to do that. It's obviously a build-up to today's game, and you do get the old... I'm not sure if it's in this piece or if it's in the Sunday World piece, but, you know, you get the old cliche of, you know, if you know, if we're not up to it now, New York will give us a really tough game, like, you know. But apart from all that sort of stuff, there's a lot more to it.
There's the
cliche part of it a bit, but I think that's almost standard practice at this stage. But first, it's, you know, things around other sports about, you know, Tiger Sense on a Sunday took advantage of it. It was a great sight to see. Taking that from other sports into our own game is something that James Horn is conscious of. Looks at NBA, NFL, golf, all these different kinds of sports, and how we can progress and build bits into our game, which goes back to what Mick was saying about Eugene going over to Arsenal. You know, that there's people who are pioneers, might be a strong word on certain people, but, like, they're not afraid to look outside the bubble because they learn an awful lot from it. And it kind of goes back to the Colm O'Rourke thing where he was talking about Australia, that there's no harm in looking at these at places like that. Rather than, you know...
I think it's like having that kind of mindset to always think maybe there is another little edge or there is something to be learned from. That doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, things that have gone on in the past have all been bad, but it's to try and take what's good and build on it. And one way of doing that, sometimes that can be quite difficult in your own world. And I'm sure the county teams in kind of Mayo and Dublin Kerry aren't giving each other tips.
No,
you might be.
No.
Might be more likely to get them elsewhere.
Just on the thing of going pro, the quote from Keegan is like, I love the ethos of the GAA, the way it is, to be honest. I think you get so much more respect and pride when you put on a jersey when you're doing it, not for free, but you're always doing it for family and where you're from. I think it'd be a crying shame if it goes that way, professional. The joy and excitement the All-Ireland win brought to our club, which was, I think it was Westport, wasn't it?
Westport, the footballers, intermediate, wasn't it?
So, you know, the club is still talked about and they're the stories you have for a lifetime and you can't buy them, you know. So that's, again, it's interesting when you see such a prominent player coming out against something that has been suggested. I mean, it hasn't been suggested pay for play or anything like that, but it's potentially heading down that road. And it's interesting to see such a prominent player coming out and...
And especially, I think he's acknowledging that they probably train as professionals. Like he's saying, even at club level, you could be out 4 nights a week. But, you know, it's really the money bit would make a difference.
On that topic, kind of, you know, there was one story you brought up there a while ago as well. I'm conscious we're up against the time. It's a shorter normal pay-per-view, but very quickly there is a piece. GAA keeps its eye on the ball with rollout of digitised slitters.
Yeah, it's the sort of thing you kind of have to check the date on to make sure it's not the 1st of April, but it's a Dennis Walsh piece in the Sunday Times, and it talks about the basically the research that's gone into it to try and get this standardised the slitters. And it refers to a little piece of technology. It's a piece of technology no bigger than a 5-cent coin needs to sit in the core of the ball no more than 4 centimetres from the surface. And what the challenge is to store information on the tag that could be read by an app on the mobile phone. And so if the slitter is legitimate, the tag will say so, and a simple yes or no will flash up on the smartphone. They launched the slitters at a solid block wall from a distance of 5 metres at a speed of 55 miles per hour. This was done 100 times with each ball, and the tags that couldn't withstand the violence were discarded. And the hope is to, it says, the outcome of the slitter will be used in the Celtic Challenge, the under-17 national competition in the coming weeks, and if it passes that field test, the plan is to roll it out of the digital slitter for the competitions in 2020. So, you know, whether it's good enough for a Munster Championship or not, you'll have to see, you know. But
is this an enormous effort just to stop a few teams, you know, smuggling up their own little slitter for a penalty or something like that?
Yeah, it seems to be. Like, I mean, I'm not of hurling stock. Shane Stapleton or someone like that will probably give into more details on that kind of thing. But yeah, I mean, look, it would appear you made reference to the Donal O'Cues a couple of years ago where there was...
Yeah, you compare it to kind of some of the ball tampering in cricket.
Yeah.
Like, I'm certainly no expert, so I couldn't say what difference it would make. But again, people seem to be always looking for these tiny edges. So I suppose anything that kind of introduces an element of fairness is to be welcome. Yeah. But it's kind of crazy how that kind of... how technology is kind of becoming increasingly integrated to our sports and kind of the impact it has.
Mm-hmm. Also talks about the potential for, you know, if the tag is successful, the possibilities to harvest other in-game data are endless. So, you know...
Who's hitting the ball hardest?
So the old kind of just go and win your own ball thing would be, you know, slightly obsolete. But it just says in the evolution of the game, this idea was a quantum leap for those who had the vision and stamina to follow it through. It's a triumph. So, I mean, Dennis Walsh would be one of the go-to people for hurling. So, I mean, if he's interested and excited about it, it's obviously a big deal. Like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, next up, take your pick. You mentioned Ruby Walsh, Sean O'Brien, Jack Grealish, Caster Semenya. What do you want to go with?
Well, I suppose it'd be difficult this week not to kind of, I suppose, acknowledge Ruby and, like... Aidan was saying it's perfect for him when someone announces their retirement on a Wednesday for the Sundays.
Yeah, the Sunday columnists, if an icon can, licking their lips.
Well,
if an icon can go on a Wednesday, it gives Sunday columnists plenty of time to.
Well, they were spoiled. They could choose from Ruby Walsh, John O'Shea, Paul Flynn.
Yeah, I think did they all happen on the same day? I think Flynn and Ruby weren't they? But there was plenty for them to get their teeth. But across the board, I mean, there's. It was Eamon Sweeney in the Sin, that was Roy Curtis in the Sunday World. I think this didn't actually see it, but someone said there was 16 pages of them in the Racing Post. Yeah, Shane McGrath, Philip Quinn. There's I mean, like, there's a lot of tributes about what sort of person he is, in as much as like there's a couple of little sort of technical things around the how good of a jockey he was and why he was such a good jockey. But as an actual, you know, on a personal level, he's extremely popular, and you know that's reflected in the tone of all the pieces this week.
Yeah, and I thought Eamon Sweeney's piece it was good, because in a lot of it, it's actually just kind of laying out. It's like a short little biography of him. You know the great winners he's had, his record of 59 winners, 11 leading jockeys titles and 7 winners at one Cheltenham Festival are likely to be surpassed. Those victories included 2 Gold Cups, 4 Champion Hurdles, 3 Champion Chases, 5 Stayers Hurdles, 6 Supreme Novice Hurdles, 8 Mares Hurdles and 4 Ryanair Chases. And even just the opening paragraph was, he'd always been a man who knew exactly when to make the decisive move.
Yeah.
And I actually did love the fact that he just had a big winner, he got off the horse and said, right lads, that's it, I'm done.
Can you find someone later for Live, Love, Laugh?
Yeah.
Was the line. That was how he told Willie Mullins. Like, it's,
Long goodbye.
No.
No, this is his last Cheltenham. This is his last entry.
Yeah,
this is
yeah.
his last Punchestown yeah. Festival for months and months.
Yeah.
It was just, that's it, I'm done. Now, I know a lot of people were speculating he might be calling it a day sometime soon, but just decide on a whim.
No, I think it's brilliant. And Eamon Sweeney too was like, thanks to the memories, champ, he made life more fun for a lot of us. And, you know, when these guys like who kind of have this almost transformational impact on their sport, because what they've come along and done has just never been done before, and then they do what hasn't been done before consistently, you know, for them to be able to kind of ride off into the sunset on their own terms, you know, is fantastic.
Especially in a sport like racing, yes, where the list of injuries he has had is documented here.
And the people who have, you know, been seriously injured or passed away, who he would have known, obviously.
Like in 1999, he suffered a broken leg after crashing into a protruding rail in the Czech Republic. Just 2 weeks after returning from a broken collarbone, he broke the same leg in a training accident the same year and missed 5 months of the season. In 2008, he suffered a ruptured spleen when kicked by a horse after falling at Cheltenham. It required an emergency operation to remove the organ, and Ruby was back in action 27 days later. In 2010, a broken arm was followed by a fractured tibia and fibula. A year later came a crushed neck vertebrae after a fall at Killarney. And that's aside from the cracked ribs, the broken ribs, minor injuries, the day-to-day things.
Yeah. I think it's been said many times before, like, I think it's the only sport where the competitors are followed around by an ambulance, you know, as routine. You know, and this, it's astonishing what they put their bodies through to get on the horse, you know, the keeping the weight down and all that kind of stuff. Never mind what they put their bodies through to try and, you know, get back on the horse if they fall. You know, it's these people, like as Sarah said, they've been around for so long. It's actually hard to visualise, like a Cheltenham, you know, Mullins and Ruby. That's all. It's just all you just hear it the whole time. You wouldn't be into horse racing much, but
yeah, the relentlessness of racing as well. Because we talk about Punchestown and Cheltenham and Leopardstown at Christmas, and then but you forget these guys are often off all parts of England, you know, during the week, or even other parts of Ireland as well. Racing, it's one tough sport. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah, and when he was trying, when he was with Nichols, I can't remember which piece it was, but he was saying about when there was, you know, the workload that he put himself through to try and ride with Mullins
and Nichols at the same time,
which is just an astonishing feat, to just logistically almost to pull it off, and then to keep his standards so high, because I mean, Mullins and Nichols obviously both love him, but if he wasn't doing the job, that's the nature of professional sport. If he wasn't doing the job, they weren't keeping him because he was a nice fella. They were keeping him because he was the best around, and they were happy to go with that. And he was happy to put that amount of time and investment and energy into it. And yeah, it's brilliant for him. And that's, as I said, that's reflected in the pieces of just how when someone retires, there's rarely a bad word about him. But there's a genuine kind of warmth across all the pieces of what people say about him.
And also, as well, something we mentioned a few minutes ago, talking about GA, where you don't really find out about people. Ruby Walsh was someone who had no problem letting you know who he was, and no problem hiding away from giving you a line in an interview.
Yeah,
you know, it was straight up. It was there was no act whatsoever.
You see that with Ted on the coverage as well. Like, you know, the apple didn't fall far, but
not a chance.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, it's probably one of the good things about racing. Actually, I hadn't thought about it before, but just the way in which it's covered and it's so integrated with broadcast, you know, with the races being covered by TV or anything, and then them doing the interviews afterwards, there isn't that much kind of regulation in a way that I think the jockeys and the trainers and the owners all see themselves as very much kind of part of the industry and know that the media are another part of it, so are probably more open to having the chats with the media afterwards, because as I said, that's a key part of kind of keeping the interest going.
Okay. And where we are running out of time ever so slightly. Sean O'Brien is in pretty much all the Sunday papers today, interviewed ahead of next weekend's Champions Cup final, next Saturday's Champions Cup final against Saracens. There is one big line in it though. I would have stayed for a quarter of the cash. Obviously he's moving to London Irish on a big money contract on a 3-year deal for next season. Which is there any one of those interviews across the papers though that kind of jumped out best for you?
Not particularly, in the sense, like in a lot of cases with Sunday papers where they have the same person to interview, I think at times they...
And they all have the same quotes.
They all have the same quotes, but the good thing about this is they're good quotes. So in fairness, more or less every one of the papers just lets the quote stand for themselves. You know, I mean, he's...
Well, you were saying the tabloids got straight
to the point. Yeah. There was a little bit.
I think I read the Sunday Times piece first this morning. Yeah. And you're getting a bit into it before you get to that.
Whereas, to the point.
That's the headline.
Yeah, that's the headline there in the Sun. Yeah.
And the interview itself is further into the newspaper.
Neil O'Riordan in the Sun on Sunday says the same thing. Like, you know, it's just, it says he would have stayed at Leinster for 25% of the money, bang. And that's like more of a production side of things, same in headlines. And we were talking about that earlier on. That's the line. That's the headline. And there's no sensationalism in any of this stuff. Like that's what he said, and he's been very honest about it.
Yeah, I think that's it. Like, I think Sean O'Brien, for me, there's an automatic contrast there with the Ruby Walsh situation, because Ruby's somebody who's managed to kind of end his career on his own terms, and I think there's no doubt. I think that Sean O'Brien is probably a reluctant leaver from Leinster. I think it probably came through at the interview after the semi final game, and you know, again. You know, anytime he's asked about the departure, he comes across as very emotional, which and he talks about how he's really built himself up there. And you can see, if you stand back and look at it cold commercially, you can see why maybe the IRFU were reluctant to invest in a player of his age with his injury record. But then I was saying to Aidan, I think he's brought something really special to the Leinster setup in terms of culture, and he's a clear leader as well in that regard, and he's maybe something kind of has been something slightly different from what you would have expected.
Like someone like Tadhg Furlong, maybe a role model for people outside of the the fee paying schools.
The traditional
rugby academies, that there is a route in for you. There's a great part here in it where he's saying they actually took a bit of a chance on me, putting me straight into the academy. They gave me a few bob. I think we were getting €332 a month and getting into UCD as well. I got my accommodation and small scholarship. I was able to live, basically. Then I said to Dave McHugh, who was the manager, if there was any work going anywhere, to let me know. I used to help Johnny O'Hagan, the kit man, usually just filling ice baths and cleaning out changing rooms and shower rooms as the first team lads were finished. And he said it suited him because he was able to kind of hang around with the senior team players.
Yeah,
and I think I remember reading before about him selling his granny's brown bread on a Monday. He'd take the orders and go down home for the weekend. And even him, how he's kind of stayed involved with his club in Tullow, because, I was also saying to Aidan, I think there's a real dichotomy between what's happening in rugby clubs outside Dublin and those in Dublin. The ones outside Dublin seem to be thriving, and the ones in Dublin seem to be struggling a bit. So, again, I think he will be a big loss to the Leinster setup and probably the Irish setup, just in terms of the kind of attitude and behaviour and that kind of broader cultural piece.
He talks about the coming from Tullow versus the schools thing as well in the piece. It's like, I had a massive chip on my shoulder coming in, no point saying otherwise. I probably disliked all the school lads from the word off. The first under 18s team you came together was a schools youth mix, and when you met it was all, where are you from? Tullow. It'd be like, where's that? In a real patronising way. There's no genuine interest in where you're from. And they're kind of in their own bubble at this stage. It says it changed fairly quickly over the years. Once you give a few thumps, it changes the mindset fairly quickly.
Very quickly, yeah. Some good bits even on the mood, even just aside from, I would have taken a quarter of the money business. Would I say now that I'd be bitter? No, I'm not bitter because I get the business decision. Was there a few things I probably wouldn't be overly happy with? Yeah, there probably is. But that's probably just me being selfish in terms of wanting to be here. And, unlike Ruby Walsh, we don't all get the fairy tale ending.
No.
And to be able to go out on our own terms with whoever we want, it's
it's an interesting.
You have to make the tough decision.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing as well. Like, sort of, the rugby's still relatively young in professional senses, but it's an extremely professional decision. These kind of things happen in soccer the whole time, where, mm-hmm. you know, you've lads who are 29, someone weighs up whether past their sell-by date or not, and they're gone. And there's no kind of, I mean, Keane was a very famous example where, you know, United ditched him because he was deemed the same thing he'd been doing for the previous 10 or 12 years was no longer deemed useful versus where it was, yeah. and he was cut.
Yeah.
And that similar type of thing seems to become with O'Brien, where, like, he's an icon. If he was fit, he obviously could add, certainly could bring something to the show still for Leinster, but the decision's been made, it's been weighed up, and that's, you know, the amount of that's going to be interesting. Next, you were saying earlier on, Sarah, like, you know, other players coming towards the end of their career looking at this as, you know, this is probably going to be their reality, that, you know, yeah. they're going to be hitting the, you know, the ripe old age of 29, 30. And, you know,
yeah. Yeah. And the way rugby is going, it's very much going in, like, World Cup cycles.
Yes.
Your value is really only determined yeah. by, are you going to be here
yes.
for the next World Cup?
Yeah.
And that's going to be interesting now after, you know, after the World Cup comes around, because you don't necessarily, you think of someone who's been, you know, someone who's 27, you know, this year, they're in their prime or whatever. Mm. You go past the World Cup, then they're 31. The next World Cup comes around, and those kind of decisions yeah. are difficult decisions to make. Like, you know, and obviously, like, John O'Brien's not too happy. I'd say a lot of Leinster fans, you know, obviously trust the job. But, you know, emotionally, clinically, they know it's probably the right decision. But emotionally, and that's what it's about. Like,
yeah,
you know,
I think as well, the production line at Leinster is such at the moment, or certainly seems to be that. You know,
it's so ruthless right
now. It's so ruthless yeah. right now. Even saw the article, I think, was in the Independent yesterday with Ross and Harry Byrne. So yeah. both playing 10 as well. So Ross, I think, was saying their mother's a bit uncomfortable.
Yeah.
I can well understand why.
One of them might have to go to Munster.
Yeah.
We probably have time for one final piece.
The Semenya stuff has been interesting during the
hard
week.
Hard to avoid that. Yeah.
Hard to avoid that. Yeah, yeah. Tommy Connellan's piece in the Sunday Independent kind of details the case really kind of from one end of the week to the next, which can be sometimes frustrating in a column when they're kind of referring to things that happened during the week. But in this instance, such a complicated case.
It's no harm just
it's
having
no
the
harm
facts laid
actually
out
have
front
the facts
you,
laid
yeah.
out in front. So he kind of, there's a, the intro on it just says, on Friday evening, Caster Semenya called on God to be your source of wisdom, King Solomon having left the building 2 days earlier. And it kind of, you know, just goes through. I mean, it's interesting. It's very clearly not black and white. And Tommy Connell doesn't come down on one side or the other.
Yeah.
In the Sunday Times, David Walsh, it's a similar type of background on it, but he does come down on the side of saying,
yeah, it was a tough decision, but
yeah,
the right one.
The right
is what
one.
He says.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, he uses the sort of the intro was about a friend of his who played in a golf club, and there was a male who lived yeah. as a man until 53, then defined herself as female, and his friend was saying that the handicap system will sort it out, which
yeah,
and
how she,
people down.
You know,
yeah.
people at one golf club had been very uncomfortable
yes.
with her suddenly identifying as a woman and playing off ladies' tees,
yes.
so
yeah.
she went on
yeah.
to a new club and a new club
yeah,
until she was finally kind of accepted. Until
yeah, the 18th hole when she won the longest drive, yeah. And the friend wasn't too happy about that. Like it's an analogy of sorts. I mean, there's no analogy for Semenya, which is the whole point about the week. Like this is it's a unique case, and you can kind of go around in circles with it. I mean, most people acknowledge that there's an element of advantage that she has enjoyed in but she has paid for it in enormous ways over the years. Like how she's been treated. And yeah, like that's the thing. There's no, you'd say probably morally right or wrong decision. There is probably a morally or ethically a morally right decision where it's not really fair to ask her to take those, you know, to reduce her levels of testosterone. But I think that's, again, as David Welch says here, they had to discriminate. The last paragraph, the cast knew it had to discriminate against one or other, as in Semenya or the rest of the athletes. Mm-hmm. And it chose to discriminate against a numerically smaller group. It was a tough decision, but also the right one.
But is it discriminating against the larger group to let her another run as they are?
Yeah, well, what they say that the hard cases make kind of bad law, so I'm not sure that answers that question, but I think it's one of those, like, what this is definitely a conundrum, but I have to kind of, having read David Walsh's piece, it's probably, you know, I feel Semenya's probably paid a huge price and that there's things about her that, you know, we probably in some ways don't need to know. But I, you know, if you've got one group of, I suppose what he's saying there, that either way it was a bad decision, but what it, the decision that's been made is probably trying to be fairer to the broader number of people, you know, to... So it's tricky, but you know, I think it's one of those things that makes people uncomfortable because, again, on a human level, you kind of feel for somebody like Semenya. But at the same token, in some ways, what for me is kind of missing, I wonder, it would be interesting to know the thoughts of the people that came second or thirds in the Olympics to to Semenya's. You know, how does that other group of kind of athletes feel? And that's one piece that's probably kind of been missing from the commentary. You can understand why as well. I'm sure they don't want to put their heads above the parapet. But, you know, I suppose it's whatever you can do to kind of maintain the welfare of the broader number of athletes is probably where you need to end up on this one. But not an easy one at all.
Yeah, no, it's like, I mean, it's unfair. There's no kind of getting away. It's on a personal level for Semenya, it's dreadful. And as you said, sorry, like, there are things written about her you don't necessarily need to know in terms of, you know, what internal organ she does or doesn't have. And you're kind of, you know, all this stuff is laid. Nobody would want that laid out about themselves and in that kind of level of detail. But it's, yeah, like the Sunday pieces, like, you couldn't avoid talking about it this week. There's a couple of other pieces around it, but obviously, like, I mean, it's obviously a very, very busy weekend. So it's the sort of thing that, had it happened in a quieter weekend, it's a different time of the year, it would have been a huge thing for the papers. But it's covered, but it's something that I don't think there's, in any of the pieces that you read, there hasn't been a satisfactory piece. And that's no criticism of the people writing it. It's just an unsatisfactory case nobody can end up happy with it. Like, you know, it's...
Yeah, it looks like there will be another appeal, I think, to the Swiss Federal Tribunal. So it's probably one that's going to run on for a while yet as well.
Okay, guys, we are out of time. I know there was another piece on Jack Grealish across the papers as well that you found very interesting. I read it as well. It was very, very good. He's in Sunday Times. I saw him in the Mail on Sunday Oliver too. Holt as well. But that is all we have time for. There is a comment in as well on our GA commentary. The championship starts with a whimper. It matters a lot in Connacht. That's from John in Leitrim. Fair enough, I suppose.
There you go,
We were probably referencing more the actual coverage of
the event and, you know, the kind of the big build up and that kind of thing, more so than the teams involved. I mean,
is that happening now when we lose April?
I think so. Again. I think it's disappeared.
I think a little bit. Like, I think April, it's almost like anything. You know, you get back from kind of a holidays, don't you? And it takes you a day or two to kind of get up to speed. And it's almost like we've been, we haven't had the kind of GAA conversation in April, so we're taking a while.